All right, strap in, everybody. We're going deep on a case that really turned the world of juvenile justice upside down, Grand V, Florida.
Oh, yeah, this one is a biggie.
You've got some really interesting stuff for us to dig into, and I, for one, am ready to get going.
Absolutely.
Court documents, expert opinions, we've even got some insights into those teenage brains.
The science is wild.
Basically, everything we need to figure out just why Grand V, Florida is considered such a landmark case.
I think what's really fascinating about this case is how it makes us ask some tough questions.
Like what?
Like, can we really say that a teenager deserves to die in prison?
Right, for a crime where no one was killed.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was exactly what was at stake for Terrence Green.
16 years old.
The teenager at the center of this whole thing.
Yep.
So let's back up and lay out the facts of the case.
All right, so we're in Jacksonville, Florida,
Okay.
and Terrence was involved in this robbery at a restaurant.
Robbery at a restaurant.
No one was hurt.
But he's still charged and tried as an adult.
That's right.
That right there, I mean, that's kind of crazy to think about.
It is.
A 16-year-old facing the same consequences as, you know, a full-grown adult.
Yeah, and it gets even more complicated.
Oh, how so?
Well, because in Florida at the time, they'd abolished the parole system.
No parole.
So that life sentence, it really meant life in prison.
No chance of getting out.
Nope, no matter what.
So even if he, like, you know, totally turned his life around in prison, got an education, showed remorse,
Didn't matter.
nothing.
He would be locked up until he died.
Wow. So Terrence actually ended up taking a plea deal.
He did, yeah.
And got probation.
Which, I mean, considering everything seems like a pretty reasonable outcome.
Yeah, you'd think that would be the end of it, right?
Right.
But there's always a but, isn't there?
Always a but. So 6 months later, Terrence is arrested again,
Oh boy.
this time for allegedly being involved in a home invasion robbery.
Okay, so now we've got some serious charges.
Very serious.
And remember, no parole in Florida.
Right.
So what happened?
He got hit with a life sentence for the armed burglary charge
Wow.
from the home invasion,
Okay.
plus 15 years for attempted armed robbery.
So just like that, a teenager is basically condemned to die behind bars.
It's pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm guessing this is where the Supreme Court comes in. The
Exactly.
case goes through appeals, and now the justices have to answer a big question.
Huge.
Does sentencing a juvenile to life without parole, when no one was killed,
Right.
violate the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment?
That is the question.
Man, this is what I find so interesting about this case.
What's that?
We aren't just talking about, like, legal technicalities.
No.
We're talking about the very essence of justice.
Absolutely.
So what did the court decide?
In a 6-3 decision, they decided that, yeah, this sentence is unconstitutional.
Wow, okay.
And their reasoning is what's so fascinating.
What was it?
They used this idea of what they call twice diminished culpability
Twice diminished culpability.
for juvenile offenses.
You know, I gotta be honest, when I
Right?
saw that phrase in the court's opinion, I was like, hold on, what does that even mean?
Well, it's actually pretty simple.
Okay, good.
The court basically recognized that juveniles, just because of their age and the way their brains work,
Right.
they're just less culpable, less morally blameworthy for their actions than adults are.
So, like, teenagers just think differently.
Exactly. Think about it. I mean, teenagers, they're impulsive, they're susceptible to peer pressure.
Oh, yeah.
Their brains are literally still developing.
Still cooking.
Yeah.
So it's not that we're letting them completely off the hook,
No.
but we're acknowledging that their decision making is different.
100%. And then on top of that, you have this second layer.
Second layer of diminished culpability.
Yeah, the nature of the crime itself.
So the crime itself.
So non-homicide offenses, they're serious, don't get me wrong,
Right.
but they're not on the same level as taking a life.
So basically, the court is saying, look, we've got these young people, their brains aren't fully developed.
Right.
They messed up, yeah, but they didn't kill anybody. Life without parole is way too extreme.
It's a great way to sum it up. The punishment has to fit the crime and the offender.
I like that.
You know?
Okay, so the court says this sentence is unconstitutional, but we said earlier Florida has no parole system.
Right.
So how did this decision actually change things for Terrence Graham and, you know, others like him?
Well, it didn't mean everyone was suddenly set free or anything,
Right.
but it established a super important principle.
What's that?
States have to provide a meaningful opportunity for these individuals to eventually obtain release.
Okay.
And that would be based on them demonstrating maturity and rehabilitation.
So not a guaranteed release,
No.
but a chance to prove they've changed.
Exactly. And this is where the science about how teenagers' brains actually develop becomes incredibly relevant.
It all ties together.
It does. The court was really influenced by research showing that young people, their brains are wired for rehab.
Really?
They're still developing, they're adaptable, and they respond way better to interventions than adults do.
So we're locking them up with no chance of release.
You're essentially saying we don't believe they can change.
Yeah, and the science shows us that's not true.
Right.
It feels like this case is more than just a legal battle.
It is.
It's a reflection of how we're starting to understand young people better.
And the idea of second chances.
Exactly.
It challenges us to think about what the goal of our justice system really is.
Is it just to punish?
Or is it to rehabilitate, to offer a path to redemption, especially for those who commit crimes when they're young?
Man, that is a question that lingers, that's for sure.
It does, doesn't it?
Now, before we get too deep into the consequences of Graham, I think we need to take a look at the opinions within the court.
Okay.
Because even though it was a 6-3 decision, there were definitely some different viewpoints about how they got there.
There are some strong opinions, for sure.
Let's dig into some of those dissenting opinions next time.
Sounds good. Okay, so where do you want to start?
Let's start with Justice Kennedy.
All right.
He wrote the majority opinion, right?
Yeah, he did, and he really leaned on this idea of evolving standards of decency, basically arguing that what we consider cruel and unusual punishment, it can actually change over time as society evolves.
Makes sense. So it's not like the Eighth Amendment is just frozen in time.
Exactly. The interpretation can shift as our values change.
So what did he use to support that argument?
Well, Kennedy pointed to some pretty compelling evidence to show how our views on juvenile life without parole have actually changed. Like, for example, at the time of the Graham case, a lot of states were already moving away from giving out this kind of sentence.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, some had gotten rid of it altogether.
Okay.
And others were, like, really limiting when it could be used.
So it's not like this was just, like, a few rogue justices making a really radical decision?
Right. It was part of a trend we were seeing across the country.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
And then Kennedy takes it a step further.
He does.
Yeah, he looks at international norms, and he points out that the U.S. was pretty much the only developed country that was still allowing this kind of sentence for juveniles.
Oh, wow. So we were really out of step with the rest of the world on this?
Yeah, pretty much. And that global perspective really added weight to his argument that, like, there was this growing global consensus against juvenile life without parole for crimes where no one was killed.
Makes sense. So we've got shifting societal values, international norms.
Right.
But Kennedy doesn't stop there, does he? He also brings in those penological goals of punishment that we were talking about earlier.
Oh, he totally does. And it's amazing how he just systematically dismantles the arguments for life without parole, specifically in these cases involving juveniles.
Okay, break it down for us.
So he starts with retribution, that idea of, like, an eye for an eye.
Right. Classic.
But he argues that it doesn't carry the same weight when you're dealing with young offenders.
Because they're less culpable.
Exactly.
Because of their developmental stage.
Right. So then he moves on to deterrence, the idea that harsh punishments will scare people straight and prevent future crimes.
Right, right, right.
But Kennedy points out that, like, the research on that is not very strong, especially when it comes to teenagers.
Yeah, they're not exactly known for thinking things all the way through.
They are impulsive.
They can be easily influenced by their peers.
Yeah. They aren't exactly known for their long-term planning skills.
I mean, if you're a teenager and you're facing, like, a tough choice, are you really sitting there thinking, well, better not do this or I might get life in prison?
Right.
No, it's just not how their brains work.
Nope. And that takes us to incapacitation. So removing dangerous individuals from society to keep everyone else safe.
Sure, yeah.
Kennedy acknowledges that that is a valid goal. But he says it shouldn't be the only thing we're considering, especially when we're talking about young people who still have a lot of potential for change.
Right. So even if, like, we need to, you know, keep someone off the streets for a while for the safety of everyone else, that doesn't mean we should completely shut the door on them ever becoming a productive member of society.
Exactly. And that leads into the big point he's building toward.
Okay.
Rehabilitation.
Oh, yes.
He argues that, especially for these young offenders, this has to be our primary goal.
Yeah, because their brains are still developing, they're more open to interventions, they've got a way better shot at actually turning their lives around than someone older might.
Exactly. So when we just lock them up and say, nope, no chance of ever getting out.
It's like we're saying we don't believe in their ability to change at all.
Right. And Kennedy makes a very strong case that the science doesn't support that.
You know what? This whole decision, it feels bigger than just like one case.
I know what you mean.
It feels like it's about a really fundamental shift in how we think about young people in the eyes of the law.
Absolutely. Graham v. Florida is a really powerful statement about the potential for redemption, even for people who make some really big mistakes when they're young. But we do have to talk about those dissenting opinions.
Yeah.
Because there were some justices who did not agree with the majority. Even though they agreed on the outcome for Terrence Graham, they had some pretty different ideas about how they got there.
Right. Because even when they agree, looking at why can be really informative.
100%.
I'm especially curious about what Justice Thomas had to say, because it seemed like he took issue with the whole idea of proportionality in sentencing.
Yeah, he did. Thomas argued that the Constitution doesn't specifically require sentences to be proportional,
Okay.
so he thought the court was kind of overstepping its boundaries by creating this new requirement.
Interesting. So it's less about the specifics of this case and more about, like, his whole judicial philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. Thomas was basically saying that sentencing should be left up to the legislatures, not the courts. Like, if society wanted to change the way juveniles are sentenced, that should happen through the democratic process.
So through elected representatives, not judges.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the other dissenting justices? Did they agree with Thomas?
Not completely. Justice Alito, he focused more on like the procedural side of the
Oh,
case.
okay.
He was saying that Terrence Graham hadn't properly made his Eighth Amendment argument in the lower courts,
Gotcha.
so he thought the Supreme Court shouldn't even be looking at that issue.
So it was a more technical legal argument.
Exactly. Alito felt like the court was exceeding its authority by tackling an issue that hadn't properly gone through the lower courts.
Interesting. So we've got these dissenting opinions, and they really add some nuance to how we understand the case as a whole.
They do. They do.
I mean, even if they didn't agree with the majority's reasoning, it does seem like they were all grappling with the same basic idea.
What's that?
That a life sentence for a kid who didn't kill anyone, that's got to be a problem, right?
Yeah, you're right. Even Chief Justice Roberts, who agreed that Graham's sentence was unconstitutional, he wasn't totally on board with how the majority got there. He thought it should be a case-by-case review rather than just like a blanket ban.
So even if they didn't all agree on the reasoning, they all agreed that something just wasn't right about sentencing a kid to basically die in prison for a crime where no one was killed.
Absolutely. And I think that really speaks to the changing tide of public opinion. Like, there's this growing recognition that children are different.
And they deserve a chance at redemption.
Exactly. And Graham v. Florida reflects that change in a really powerful way.
But it makes you wonder, what happens after the Supreme Court makes a big ruling like this? Does it actually change how juvenile offenders are treated out in the real world?
You're asking the million-dollar question. How do these big legal principles translate into actual change?
Yeah.
And that's what things get really interesting.
Okay, so we've seen how Graham v. Florida was this major turning point, but what happened next?
Right. Did it just sort of disappear into the legal ether, or did it actually lead to any lasting changes?
Did it make a difference on the ground, you know, in how we think about juvenile justice?
Oh, it definitely did not just fade away. Actually, Graham really set the stage for a whole series of Supreme Court decisions
Okay.
that completely reshaped how we approach juvenile justice in America.
So it was like opening the door
Yeah.
for even more significant changes.
Exactly.
What were some of those big cases that came after?
Well, one of the most important ones was Miller v. Alabama. That one was decided just a couple of years after Graham,
Okay.
and it tackled this question of mandatory life without parole for juveniles, but this time for those convicted of homicide.
So even for like the most serious crimes imaginable,
Right.
the court was starting to rethink these really harsh sentences for young people.
They were, and the Miller case, it really built on the foundation that Graham had laid. It emphasized the science, you know, the whole idea of adolescent brain development and diminished culpability.
So in the end,
The court ruled that mandatory life without parole for juveniles, even in murder cases, it violated the Eighth Amendment.
wow, that must have been a huge win for people who'd been advocating for juvenile justice reform.
It was a really big shift.
Because it's basically acknowledging that even when a young person has taken a life, you still have to factor in their age and how their brain is still developing, right?
Absolutely. The court recognized that these young people, they did something terrible, but you have to look at their actions within the context of like they're still developing brains, their potential to change and grow.
So Graham sets the precedent for non-homicide offenses, and then Miller extends those protections to even homicide cases.
Right.
What else happened in the wake of all these decisions?
Well, then we had Montgomery v. Louisiana.
Montgomery v. Louisiana.
That was 2016. And that one clarified that Miller, it wasn't just about cases going forward, it was about recognizing a fundamental constitutional right
Okay.
that applied retroactively.
Whoa, hold on. So even people who had already been sentenced to life without parole as juveniles, like before Miller even happened,
Yep.
they might get a second chance.
Exactly.
Wow.
Montgomery led to literally thousands of resentencing hearings all across the country. It gave people who had been in prison for decades, you know, sometimes since they were teenagers, a chance to have their sentences looked at again.
That's pretty amazing. It's like the legal system admitting, hey, we might have messed up here and trying to right a wrong. But I'm curious, have all these legal changes, have they actually changed the way things work in practice? You know, like, are we seeing fewer juveniles getting sentenced to life without parole?
Yes, we are. We've seen a big decline in the number of juveniles getting those life without parole sentences. A lot of states have gotten rid of it completely.
Okay.
Or they've made it so it can only be used in very specific cases. They're choosing sentences that allow for parole or that take into account the offender's age, their chances of rehabilitation.
It sounds like these cases weren't just these abstract legal battles. They actually made a real difference in people's lives.
They did. They really did. But it's important to remember this is not the end of the story.
It's not.
No. There are still debates going on, controversies about juvenile life without parole.
Right. I can imagine there are still people out there who think that for some crimes, even if the offender is a juvenile, that the harshest punishments are still justified.
Yeah, you're going to have people who say any sentence that even has the possibility of release, even if it's decades down the road, that it just doesn't bring true justice for the victims or their families, that some crimes are so bad, even a juvenile should never get a chance to walk free.
That's a hard one.
It is.
But I get where they're coming from.
And then on the other side, you have folks who believe that life sentences for juveniles, any life sentence, it's always cruel and unusual no matter the crime. That locking up a kid for life, even with the possibility of parole, it ignores the fact that they can change and grow. They want to see sentencing that prioritizes rehab and getting these individuals back into society.
Man, it's complicated.
It is. There are strong arguments on both sides.
It really makes you think about how tricky it is to balance everything. The needs of victims, the rights of offenders, making sure society is safe.
It's exactly that. That's what makes this whole issue so challenging. And in the middle of all these debates, we have to remember the human side of it all. We're talking about real people's lives, young people who messed up, sometimes really badly, but who still have the capacity to turn things around, to become better.
It's easy to get lost in the legal arguments,
It is
but these are real people.
real people with real families and real communities that are affected.
You're right. You've really captured what makes Granby, Florida so interesting. It's not just a legal case. It reflects how we're starting to understand young people differently, how we view the purpose of our justice
Oh, it
system.
does.
You know what? This whole deep dive has been pretty eye-opening.
Yeah.
We started with one teenager's story facing a life sentence,
And look where we ended up.
exploring law, science, societal values. It's all connected.
It is. And I think it brings us right back to that question we were talking about before. Is the point of our justice system just to punish?
Right.
Or is it about something more? About helping people turn their lives around, especially young people who got off track?
It's a question worth thinking about.
It is. And as individual, as a society, it's something we have to keep thinking about as we figure out what the future of juvenile justice should look like.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll see you next time.